Hey guys, welcome to the Angler's Happy Hour podcast. In this episode, we chat with our good friend, Mitch Kistner. Mitch was on the forefront of the college bass fishing scene and actually founded the Arizona State University bass team. We discuss with him what it's like traveling around the country with a bunch of college kids, and we dive into post-frontal fishing, EWG treble hooks, and we talk about how to keep an oil boat running. Make sure you guys stick around. Hey guys, I'm pretty stoked to share the news that we've partnered up with SmartLink Alarm. An Arizona-based company with over 30 years of experience, SmartLink Alarm provides custom security systems for your home or business. From now until April 1st, we've got a fun promotion going on with these guys. Give them a call, let them know your security concerns. Mention the Angler's Happy Hour podcast and receive a free quote. Receiving the quote will enter you into a drawing for a free guided trip with one of us. If you're lucky, Rob will be your guide. If you're unlucky, it'll be myself or Nick. We appreciate the fact that we have listeners all across the country, but this promo is going to be geared to the local Arizona listeners, with SmartLink Alarm servicing Arizona residents only. To enter and receive a free quote, give them a call at 480-844-0333 or visit them online at smartlinkalarm.com. Hey guys, welcome back to the Angler's Happy Hour podcast. We've got a pretty cool episode today. I already introduced our guest in the intro, but let's go right to him to start off. This is Mitch Kistner, one of our best buds. What's going on, man?
Not too much. Happy to be here. It's a pretty cool setup you got here. So,
welcome to the cave, man. Surrounded by baits, rods, mice.
Mice, yeah. Special spot. Pretty excited to meet the mice.
Yeah.
Well, that's actually why I'm here, not the three of you. But the mouse is pretty cool. Yep.
This is a high grade of hantavirus that you will inhale from here. That's why you signed that long waiver before
one
you
mouse
came.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
I noticed in the last episode, I called them mouses. I asked Cliff. I didn't say mice. I said, hey, Cliff, I think you probably have some mouses up in your garage, don't you?
I thought it was a New Hampshire thing, dude. I thought you were just bringing the home country back.
Oh, gosh. Well.
Did you tell me your grandpa says Vaseline instead of baseline?
Yeah. So, well, he's Love French, dude. He's French. And if you look... He speaks very little English, and if you and I guess he knows what Vaseline is, dude. And if you look at baseline,
what old man doesn't
Vaseline? All you do is you just replace the V and the B, dude. So
fair enough. Right?
I thought that was some like new kind of scent or something. Yeah. And Vaseline, I've been putting that on my jigs for years.
Yeah, it probably works, dude. It works for someone. Someone swears by it.
Yeah,
that's
well,
funny.
As soon as you move here, though, you pronounce well. We're from the Midwest, and we pronounce Guadalupe as Guadalupe.
Guadalupe.
Yeah.
The English language just leads you astray, right? Because in your grandpa's defense, dude, what makes baseline baseline instead of Vaseline? You know, in other languages, they at least put like an accent over a letter to tell you where to, you know, how to say it. So
they look exactly the same.
Everything.
100%.
And like three different meanings for this, or three different spellings for the same word with three different meanings. It's, I don't know. I don't know how we conquered this land with our weird language, but somehow we pulled it off.
Oh, yeah.
Go America.
I like how, so when Mitch walked in here, he goes, you guys got a pretty cool looking setup. Looks like you guys, how long did it take you to figure this all out? As he's saying that, we can't figure out how to get
mic
sound out of my mic. And we're just struggling, Nick, because we still don't have it figured out.
Yeah,
and,
but we appreciate that generous
I
assumption.
Figured that out real quick. Yeah, it looks official and it sounds good, but it's a little makeshift.
That's all that matters, yeah, as long as we look official.
The only thing that looks official, I think, is our red velour blanket draped over
tight,
the plastic table. That looks like something magical is going to happen.
How did you acquire this blanket, Rob?
I believe my mom made it, actually.
No kidding.
Yeah, she makes blankets and all kinds of stuff. So.
She made that?
She sewed it up, yeah.
Wow.
Pretty sweet, huh? Actually, for Christmas, we all got quilts that she made, which was
that's
even
really cool.
This past Christmas, you got one?
This year, yeah. So, pretty cool.
Yeah, it's... A lot of time goes into making those, man. It's pretty amazing.
It's amazing how many she produced this year, too. It's crazy. So,
they have
and every one of them was, like, specialized. Like, mine had deer heads on it. And
Heads for you, huh?
Weird, huh?
I don't get it, dude. I thought it would have been,
but,
like...
No, but everybody had their own little special thing, which was pretty cool. So,
those machines are no joke, man. A new, like, quilting or sewing machine is the cost of, like, a new half-ton pickup truck if you get a good one. They're like 30 grand or something.
I think you can sub that out. I think she's like, she makes them.
Okay.
And then you send them
out
to be
quilted.
Yeah, not India, but there's quilting places that do that. I think.
But if you want to get like the legit, I've sold houses where there's like a quilting room and it's like a third of the value of the single wide that I was standing in. I'm just kidding. But. Mitch, it's good to have you, man. I think we got sidetracked already.
No, it's all good. This is typical, so.
Yeah, no kidding, right? This is the rabbit hole.
No, this is. I'm just glad you showed up on your birthday.
Dude.
Yeah, okay, so let's go. Let's start with that real quick. We'll get into all of our topics, but it is. It's Nick's birthday.
Dude, and 19 has never felt better, I tell you what. Man, I got up this morning, everything was just.
40 is going to be a good year for you.
Yeah, right? I have the hairline of a, I don't know, maybe a 65-year-old. Right now, the body feels like that of a 65-year-old, but I think that's the toll of three kids. But.
So you get up, like, when it's your birthday and you're, like, newly married, no kids, like, your wife's, like, all excited, makes you breakfast, like, treats you really well. And, like, for me anyway, since I had kids, now it's like, the kids are up. Let's go.
Yeah. Soft.
You get this one. I get this one.
Right. Yeah. You don't wake up softly with kids anymore unless you get up at like 4 a.m. and sit in the dark and drink coffee. They have like a sixth sense to know you're awake. You can try and throw a curveball to like wake up at a weird time and they can like sense it and they just come out, which is, it's cool. I got a birthday hug from them and everything, but private moments, silent moments are, I mean, even trips to the bathroom are usually highly populated these days with lots of questions. I'm like, this doesn't bother you that the air is so thick you can see it in here? Like, no, Dad. So like I was saying, but no, man, yeah, thanks. It's the big 3-2 this year.
Right on. Happy birthday, brother. That's
great.
Well,
we appreciate you being here. We weren't sure. You know, I showed up. You weren't here yet. I asked Josh. I was like, hey, is croissant showing up? Or
oh.
Yeah, there it is. So Mitch, as you can tell, we go pretty far back with Mitch, a long way back, and Mitch gave Nick the – Nick's had a lot of nicknames.
Yeah.
And most of them –
I might need to be remembered croissant, so please continue, Josh.
Yeah, I mean, beans, croissant, all these different foods. Yeah. Beans, because he always spills the beans.
You have to explain croissant, though. Come on.
Yeah, I'll let Mitch explain croissant.
So back in the day, we weren't sure if Nick was going to show up because he was busy, he had a lot going on, and –
That's generous.
Yeah.
He's just bad with time.
Yep. And, you know, he was extra flaky. So
yes.
Kind of got the nickname croissant there for a little bit, but he's redeemed himself.
Oh, no. Fashionably late is right. There's a thin line between fashionably late and flaking like a buttered croissant. So we're good. Very thin line.
Right on. Okay. Well, first fishing question. Not even a question, but just a topic. So Mitch actually founded the ASU bass fishing team. Kind of cool. You know, it was in the, you know, Mitch, Nick, and I are all about the same age. Rob's about twice our age.
20-year senior.
No. Couple years older than
He's not in yet. We need to get the GoPros up. So
but what year did you start the club?
2007.
Sweet. And that was, you know, when did college fishing, like, really start, man? Maybe 2005?
I was going to say 2005 or 2006. And there was, I want to say, maybe 20 teams when it started. And when I started it, I was just watching TV at 4 o'clock in the morning, like we all used to do and still sometimes do before DVR. But I saw college fishing on there and I was like, man, that is awesome. That's something that I want to do. Right. So I looked into it, contacted some of the guys at ESPN and Bassmaster at the time. They kind of walked me through the process and I was like, all right, so I need to get a number of guys to get this thing going. And I didn't really know anyone my age that fished at the time.
Yeah.
So back in the day, AZ Bass Zone was everyone's friend here in Arizona.
Yeah, before social media.
Yep. Yeah. So I went on there, threw up a forum or a post on one of the forums, a thread, and had Brent Perkins, Craig Carroll write me back, and they were like, yeah, we're interested in starting it. So we had a qualifying tournament like the next weekend just to get things going, and like 2 weeks later, we drove to Texas to fish our first championship and got it going. And I'm, I want to say there was like 38 teams there maybe. And to see what it's come to today is just unreal.
How much Western presence was there? Like, when I think of the early days, I could probably vision that those 30-some-odd teams were, like, the South.
It was, yeah, it was all like the Midwest. South. We were the only team probably
did California send anyone?
Texas. So
no
kidding. Yeah, in the beginning years, there was no one. And then as things progressed, it kind of moved further west and some California teams. And,
okay.
Like Robert Matsira, who still does a lot of the video and photos for FLW.
Great
and,
guy. Yeah. Yep. Rob knows him.
Yeah.
Yep. Robbie.
On the Delta, huh?
Yeah. Character, Robbie. Yeah. Yeah. Great guy. And we had him come out. We talked him into coming out to one of the tournaments at Arkansas River. And they loved it. And that kind of started getting more people from the West involved. And now you have guys like Jacob Wall and those guys from further up north on the West Coast, too, that have done something with it, which is awesome.
Yeah, it's a huge launching pad now, and everyone knows about it. I mean, these college tournaments have 200 boats, 300 boats at them, and And those are just the top two or three teams from each school. Like, is that how it kind of works? There's a qualification on the schools that have a lot of
So
anglers?
I think it's similar to how it is this, well, back when I did it. So basically what you would do is you have club qualifiers, which we would do locally, and then your top qualifiers from the club would go to the championship. Well, since then, it's gotten so large now that they have you can't just send two teams from every state now or from every college team.
Sure.
So now they have qualifiers into the championship, and then they still narrow it down and still, what, 200 or 300 boats, which is unreal.
Yeah. Because
we used to have, if everyone sent two teams, I think at Louisville, we had over 200 teams one year. And I was like, oh, that's like in my mind, I'm like, this is it.
Yeah.
These are all
that's
anglers
the
out
max,
here.
Yeah. Sure. And now it's insane what it's become.
That's cool. So did you buy like the scales and the equipment for like that first qualifying tournament? Was that just all on you to provide that, or what did that look like?
So we just used a bag and a hand scale.
Nice.
You know,
that's
just
so
did
cool.
Old school meet out in the middle of the lake and weigh them there and record everyone's weight. And it started kind of small like that, and the team grew to like 20 people or so. So we had a treasurer, a vice president, a president.
So pretty quickly it took some structure, took shape.
It was cool. Yeah, I mean, even the college fishing stuff, it went from 38 teams at that championship to 100 the next year to 200, and it snowballed and built steam real quick.
Just goes to show there was a lot of demand. It just, you know, it was pent up, right?
Yep. Yeah, there was a lot of people out there like me at the time that wanted to fish, and they were in college, and but they didn't really know anyone, right? You go to a big university or something, and or maybe you didn't grow up around friends that fished, and it gave an outlet. And one of the things that's most amazing to me is the people that I've met throughout it. So there's people from other colleges that I still keep in touch with. I mean, you talk about Brent, Craig, Mark Walker. They're three of my best friends, and I met them all through the ASU fishing team.
That's crazy.
Which is insane.
To think about that.
Yeah.
Mark was the best man. You were the best man at Mark's wedding.
Yeah,
and,
like, it's crazy.
We were talking to Mark last night. He was up fishing with Greg Gutierrez in Shasta.
Really?
Yeah. He's living in Alaska now, and I was joking. Well, like, dude, were you trying to catch salmon on the back of his boat?
Did he just come down and fish? Was he going?
His wife has family up there, so they were visiting for the holidays.
Right. Yeah.
And was Greg guiding him, or what was the deal? Was
he just, they're just buds.
They're buddies. Okay.
Yeah,
they're
they met friends. Through college fishing,
they
of course,
did.
Right?
Oh, yeah. That's cool.
Yeah, he sent me some pictures, and I was like, oh, those look good. You eating those tonight? And he's like, oh, yeah.
They actually were.
Yeah, he goes, you want me to send you some? And I'm like,
here's a picture of some dead bass for you.
Spotted bass, probably.
The problem with telling Mark to send you some fish is he would do it.
Oh, yeah.
And not on ice or anything. It'd be a pleasant surprise when you opened it.
Like a local Kroger shopping bag, double knotted.
He is just a true Alaskan. He could do that, and his stomach would handle it. The four of us would just be dead. We'd just be have the worst sickness ever. And Mark would be like, what's wrong with you guys, you wussies? Come on.
Yeah, there's no way.
So he was made
for
Alaska.
ASU team still exist?
So it does. So it dropped off for, I want to say, 2 or 3 years. And then maybe a couple years ago, there were some guys that had tried to get it going again. So I went and met with them, and we had a little talk about it, and I kind of explained how we kind of set it up and the fundraising we did to try to get the ball rolling for them. And that was in the fall or in the spring. In the fall, they picked it back up, and now I want to say there's another 15-20 guys that are
That's
doing
great.
It. It's been running for a couple years again. So
where do you see their stuff? You guys had a huge presence. I mean,
I
didn't know any of you at that time,
right?
But I knew who you were just from, I guess it was
bad reputation, right?
No,
yeah, probably.
Arizona
Bass. Those ASUs guys
those
running around the lake.
Those drunk kids on bass boats with hand scales.
What are they, like on Facebook now or?
Instagram. They have a page on Instagram. Yeah, okay. I think it's AZ Bass Team or something like that. But they do fundraisers and they post regularly. So
very cool.
Yeah, you just wouldn't think. I mean, Arizona State University obviously is who we're talking about here. And when you think of ASU, you know, locally, it's just not, you just don't think bass fishing right away. So it's just cool that there was hidden interest. Or not even hidden, but just it was there. It just needed to be tapped.
Yeah, and I think a part of that, too, is just Arizona in a whole is always a melting pot, but in
big
general,
time.
Universities are, right?
Yeah.
So you have people coming from all over the place.
True.
But you have a lot of people coming from California, too, that do a lot of bass fishing, too. And I didn't realize when I was younger how much fishing there was in California. So it was cool. You get a lot of people from over there, and you have that common interest, and it kind of brings us all together.
How many true beginners just started, like, on the ASU team and become – decent fishermen over time?
I would say at the time maybe 50% of them,
right?
And it's pretty cool because not everyone has boats, right? So you sometimes do tournaments, team tournaments, with three people on a boat, four people on a boat to make it work, or you get volunteers. But you get people that maybe have gone fishing two or three times in their life.
They have interest in it, but they've never had the opportunity, right?
And by the end of it, they're loving it, and they're trying to enter little tournaments. And a lot of us went into the Federation after that and did some of that stuff in club tournaments. And it's cool just to learn and bounce ideas off of each other. And when you're young like that, you're thinking you just invented, like, the new wheel, right? You're, like, gluing baits together and dyeing them certain
ways.
Hey,
that's part of the fun, though, man.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it is.
Oh, yeah.
I think some of my most fun years of fishing is when I was first starting, right?
Oh, yeah.
Because you learn so quick,
and
it just makes it.
And maybe you don't have a lot of, like, experience backing you to be like, nah, that's a stupid idea, or that's never worked. When it's all new, you're just like, ah, why not? Like, glue those two things together. Try this, try that.
Well, trial and error.
Big time.
Yeah, and that's all bass fishing is in general, right? Time on the water, practice, and you don't know if it's going to work if you don't try it. So, hey, maybe it will work.
And all these kids, you know, when they're done, they graduate, they leave the club, they've got a hobby that they've got for the rest of their life, like a passion they've got for the rest of their life. So actually, I mean, dude, you had a lot to do. You started the club. You had a lot to do with, you know, a handful of dudes that have something they love for everything can do it until they die, man.
Yeah, it's very cool. It's pretty cool, yeah.
Plus, college fishing has created, I mean, some of the top names in the sport. It's really amazing how, I mean, the Lee brothers, and I mean, those are just come to my mind, but there's so many guys that are fishing. Justin Lucas.
He didn't fish college actually, but dude,
he had a part in it,
good, was emceeing for these guys early on, but yeah, I mean, so yeah, he did. And so that actually was his platform as an MC. He took a weird route, but there's got to be a dozen successful full-time professional anglers right now on just the couple main tours that came from college, and it's just starting. Every year there's two, three more. It's amazing how good and polished these guys are coming right out of it. Like, so I was the same age as Mitch, but I didn't take the college fishing route, and I kind of didn't get to go on those trips and network with all these different people. So I kind of had to learn the hard way a little bit on some of that stuff, and especially now, like, again, you guys were early on, so you know, like you said, there's 38 people at the first tournament, and you had to figure a lot of this stuff out yourself. But now, if you're a college kid and you're traveling back east with social media and just the way things are, so many different teams, your learning curve can be shortened so much. You know,
that infrastructure helps a bunch, right? Now that it's been laid.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't know. How did you guys raise money, man? Like, did you ever have to do anything silly to raise money?
Shirtless car wash. Look at Mitch's face. Nothing. He's definitely got the answer for that.
Well, I was just thinking, we used to have a side bet that whoever lost last tournament had to wear this Tigger costume I had to the next tournament. So you'd just see this bright orange Tigger running across.
Dude, that's awesome.
So we'd have fun stuff like that. But fundraiser-wise, we do charity tournaments, or like a fundraising tournament. So we'd go out to Pleasant. The Federation would usually help us out, and we would do like a 50% payback, and we'd take 50% for travel. Or we'd go to Bass Pro or Sportsman's and sell hot dogs and t-shirts. And it was amazing because, like, Bass Pro, the amount of support, like, in the industry for college fishing in general at the time was great. It's still great now. But we would go to Bass Pro. They'd supply hot dogs and brats and everything. And we'd show up with shirts and sell the hot dogs. And we'd make $400 or $500. And that's half the trip right there for us.
Yeah,
so
that's pretty cool.
It was really
very cool.
Yeah.
Dude, do you remember, and I totally forgot about this until I asked this question, but I'm sure you remember. You probably set it up. How about the tomato throwing it Joey?
Oh, yeah.
Do you guys ever hear about this?
Yeah.
I did, yeah.
Yeah.
This was amazing. So they held this. It was a ASU benefit tournament, charity tournament, to benefit the club. And there's one kid in the club that just, good guy, great kid. You know, we all know him, but he just ran
his
mouth.
Lightning rod.
Dude, he ran his mouth on the internet, and he was a lightning rod. And everyone just had something to say to this guy. And whose idea was the tomatoes? Yeah.
I honestly might say it was Joey's.
He just took one for the team.
I can see that. Yeah, he just has the awareness to
he's
get
okay
her
with
done.
It. Yeah, I mean, he stirs the pot, and he knows he stirs the pot,
great.
Right? And he's a good guy, and most of the time it's all in good fun.
Yeah.
But yeah, there was a line of people out there to throw tomatoes at him.
Yeah.
And I remember he was up against the old hookup tackle shop that's there.
So the owner of the tackle shop owned a big produce company who supplied the tomatoes, right?
Yeah.
And it was a metal building.
Yes, that's the best part. Because he sat there in a chair in front of this metal building, and every tomato that missed Joey would just make this loud thump, like straight against the wall. And if it was silent, you knew it was a direct hit. And Josh got back there, and I remember, because did you used to pitch in high school?
Dude, Justin Thompson and myself were like the baseball players at the event.
And Josh is at your touching high 90s, right?
Oh, man. I mean, these tomatoes were flying. If they didn't disintegrate in the air because they were going so fast, but they when they hit, it was
that's not as soft of a a projectile as one might think. So a tomato probably feels pretty good when it kisses you.
And it was like what, $1 a tomato?
It was it might have been, I think it was $20 for three tomatoes, and Jess and I spent all our money. I don't think I ever hit him, but Justin just nailed him a few times. And I remember his girlfriend just sitting there watching it in pain. Like,
yeah,
he was handling it much better than his girlfriend. His girlfriend was just dying.
Yeah, that was good.
That's great, man. That's cool. So, yeah, so that's great. So you had that support. But, like, I mean, what was it like in the early days, you know, trying to travel back east with you're still broke college kids, you know?
Yeah, right. I mean,
you don't have brand new vehicles. You don't have brand new boats.
Shoestring budget, right?
Did you ever have, like, any mechanical malfunctions traveling back
all the time?
What did you had an F-150 that was a pretty, like, at the time, a pretty late model truck, but that thing had like 400,000 miles on it, didn't it?
Yeah, that wasn't even the problem, child. I was talking to Brent last night, and I was like, man, what, we need to talk about some stories. And he's like, you remember the expedition? I was like, oh yeah.
Ooh,
his expedition.
Yeah, that's prior to me knowing you.
It was Brent's, and the alternator on the truck went out on the drive to Texas. And
you don't need those.
So we didn't have anywhere to pull over to get an alternator because it's the middle of the night. So he's taking batteries out of the bass boat and swapping them in the truck and running through all the batteries until we get there and can get an alternator.
Got three on the boat and that. So did four batteries get you as far as you needed to go?
We got there. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. I mean, there's
sounds like a Duralast commercial.
Yeah. There was another time we were driving through Texas and it was probably 2-3 in the morning, and I was in my truck and boat. Mark was behind me with his truck and boat, and the other guys were meeting us there. And something didn't feel right on the truck, and I'm like, hey, Mark, can you just pull up beside me real quick, make sure everything's good on the trailer? And he's like, yeah, no problem. And he gets beside me. He's like, pull over. pull over. And I was like, all right. So I swerved off the freeway. There was an exit right there, and I get out, and I'm looking, and I'm like, man, everything's fine, like on the truck. What
we
are
still
you talking
have four
about?
Tires.
And he's just standing there pointing at the trailer. And I look down, and the whole, not just the tire, the whole wheel is gone. Just completely gone. And it's like maybe, what, 2 inches off the ground, right? So it's probably sparking the whole way as we're driving. And I'm like, you've been back there for how long? You didn't see a tire go by you going 70 at some point?
He's the man, dude. Yeah.
The thought that comes to mind, I remember Dumb and Dumber, when they finally get there, he's like, you mean to tell me this whole time you've had two pairs of gloves on? Right, same type of.
Yeah, I mean, we had leaf springs go out. Craig and I were on a trip. We went and fished Kentucky Lake for a big bass tournament, a college tournament. And then we went straight from there to the Arkansas River to fish ESPN Bassmaster College Tournament after that. So we were gone for a full month. And it was the last day of weigh-ins, and we had a bad tournament. And we're driving to the weigh-in, and, like, the trailer's just bouncing weird. And we're like, oh, it's not good. And all of a sudden, some smoke's coming out. And we get there, and the leaf spring had broken. So the trailer's just riding on the top of the tire. And so we're calling frantically everywhere to get a leaf spring, right? But it's 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock on a Friday afternoon.
Oh, no.
Everyone's short closed. Supply. We're supposed to leave the next morning. We sat in a hotel room for 2 days in Arkansas until we could get a leaf spring on Monday morning. And the worst part was we couldn't even go fishing.
Yeah.
Because we couldn't get the boat off the trailer.
Stuck in the hotel.
So we just literally sat in the hotel room for 2 days.
Shotgunning
after we had been together for
light.
A month. So we were like at each other's throats. We were like, we needed our space at that point.
No kidding. We've talked about that on the show before. That's a long time. It could be your best friend. That's a long time to be with your best friend.
Well, it's funny how you go to a tournament and you can't wait to get there, and then you cannot wait to get home.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just no matter how well you do, right?
Yeah, right.
That's
you
just
have,
how it is.
You just like go through a whole range of experience and emotion. At the end of it, you're just spent. Sleep
so to
deprivation.
Be stuck there for 2 days, that'd be brutal.
Yeah.
After a month. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it was rough.
So that's over summer break. Were most of these tournaments like on summer break, or were some of them during the school year?
Most of them were summer break. Yeah, so they did all the big championships summer break. And then when FLW started doing the College Series, some of those would be on regular weekends because they'd back up to, I think it was the Everstarts at the time. So we would drive out there usually like Friday night and fish Saturday and then drive back.
Right on.
Were you, dude, this is just a random thought. Were you in a fraternity in college?
No, no.
Okay. I couldn't remember if you were because I say maybe that would have been a way to tap into some talent, you know, maybe make people do like a keg stand and as their initiation, keg stand on the dock. Try and get, you know, you think of college.
Just shaking his head.
And then you could get like a brand and like brand like a jumping bass.
None of those dudes get up at 5 a.m. to go bass fishing. Well, I'm telling you.
No, that's true. I mean, it's funny you say that because
they just don't go to bed, dude. That's how they make
exactly.
it work.
Exactly.
Valid point.
Right. You don't need sleep in college.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, in college, I lived with three guys. And so we'd have the ASU tournaments on Saturday morning. And so all my roommates would be partying all night.
Yeah, perfect.
And so I would tap out at like midnight because I'm like, not because I was drinking, like because I had to get up in the morning.
Energy is a good
thing.
So
I'd be sitting in the boat, right, rigging tackle, and everyone's out there making fun of me. And I'm like, that's fine. You know, I got something to do tomorrow.
Good for you, man.
And I'd get up at 3 o'clock to drive to the lake, and everyone still be partying. They're like, all right, we'll see you later, Grandpa. Have a nice time at the lake.
That's good.
I loved it, yeah.
Did you start the team your freshman year, or was it later?
No, I started it. I think it was my junior year.
So you had 2 years with it.
Yeah, I took a little bit longer than I probably should have to graduate. So,
man, 7 year plan works for everyone.
So I had some extra years in there, yeah. But
and you graduated with a marketing degree?
Graphic design. Okay. Yeah, well, visual communication is what they call it. But yeah,
dude, you should
design.
See him draw a stick figure. He's good.
Yeah, it's solid.
He's got
it. I need
it.
A computer to do it.
Use paint.
And you're using that degree in your career now, right?
Yeah, yes and no. So once I graduated, I did a lot of graphic design. And then the further I got into it, the more I realized I was into the marketing side of it too. But graphic design kind of got me into the door in a lot of aspects. And then I picked up a lot of the marketing stuff just through experience. But even to this day, like I'll still jump in on projects when we need help for the graphic design stuff, which has been good. So I think even like in the college fishing days, it kind of altered my perception of what I wanted to do because getting sponsors and dealing with marketing departments and stuff, I'm like, oh, this is a fun career. This could be cool. So I kind of took that path after there.
Very cool.
Yeah, you know, thinking the fraternity and making fun of that. I remember when we first time I met you was a Federation tournament at Roosevelt. Do you remember that? And I drew you. I was fishing as a co-angler.
Yeah.
And I remember giving you a hard time because you had some like really nice designer-esque jeans on. And typically at a Federation tournament, you got some like hustlers or rustlers, whatever those are called.
Hustlers.
You know what
I
mean? Saying?
I don't know what kind of tournaments you're going
you
to.
Don't want
leather with a little bit. No, but that was I remember. And then we drew each other and had a good time fishing. But I gave you pretty hard. I think right out of the gate, insults and nicknames were being labeled and flung back and forth. And we knew we had something
that
special.
Right. Yeah, it didn't take long.
Yeah, no, it didn't at all. I think we both bombed, if I remember correctly. But a great friendship blossomed in the making.
It was a cold day. I remember that.
That's cool. The three of us have had tons of, like a lot of my best fishing memories, these two are involved.
Well, before Josh was big time, man, we sprung board you in the 2012, man. We went on the open circuit with you and watched you do some big things.
You guys were a huge part of it. You know, Mitch.
Mostly me.
Well, yeah, obviously.
Just kidding. Nick. Totally kidding.
Nick is the biggest part of everything.
Yeah, that's right.
In my life,
just
for
asking.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
Just
asking, exactly. That's but true. Yeah, both these guys did, you know, sharing information. Mitch helped me with some different stuff on some cluing me into some bites and stuff like that year. Nick let me borrow his boat one tournament when I was out, and then he just practiced with me. But all that nice stuff, this is not what this podcast is about. It's about throwing each other under the bus.
Yeah, it really is. But when you're under there enough, you can change the oil. I remember, though, Mitch is actually very handy. And the last of those opens that year was at Fort Gibson. And, you know, Josh had to do well to qualify, which he did. But I remember there was a backwater in practice that we really wanted to get access to, and we got this really bright idea to try and use some shovels to gain access, and we snapped one of them in half. And then you remember the trophy that Mitch made for you?
It's in my office. I'll show you guys when we're done. But yeah, we used these shovels. I mean, Mitch found this backwater, and no one could get into it. So we all
dredged our way.
Yeah, we called the tournament director and asked, is it legal to take a shovel and
create
a
channel?
Yeah, just make it accessible. He goes, as long as it's connected by water, which it was, you just can't take anything out of the water. We called whoever the Oklahoma Department of wildlife or whatever, the Army Corps of Engineers, and the four of us, we battled the water moccasins and snapping turtles and dug a channel into here.
Locals playing banjos.
Midge and I made hay the next 2 days back there.
What was the ruling on it? Was it you could do it prior to the tournament starting? Because you had to get out of your boat to dig, right?
Yep.
And you can't get out of the boat during the tournament, right?
Exactly. Yep. Mm-hmm. Prior to the tournament starting, and you just couldn't take anything out of the water. Like, if this was Arizona, I'm sure it wouldn't be legal, dude. But things are pretty lax in Oklahoma. And as long you could move stuff around in the water, you just can't take it out of the water.
Well, that almost made it harder because trying to shovel gravel underwater, we're like, oh, it's only, what, 15 yards that we had to get across. Yeah. But it took,
30 minutes,
what, 3 hours?
Yeah, it kept filling later. Back in. Oh, you'd shovel it out, it'd fill right back in.
It was brutal.
Ridiculous.
But yeah, we went in there. I remember the last day, so Josh and I had talked, and we both caught some fish in there on day one, I believe. And then day two, we're like, all right, well, we're going to go run some other places because it wasn't as great as we thought it was going to be. And I was like, all right, well, at like 10 o'clock, I was like, man, I don't have anything going on. I'm just going to go back in there. And I pull in there, and Josh is in there. I'm like, looks like we're both struggling again. And I get in there, and he's like, oh, it's not good. And then I get past one of the boats on the outside of the like sandbar, and he's like, dude, it's on fire. It's going down. So I start digging through my boat, right, because we're throwing biffle bugs, of course, on Fort Gibson. And to lighten the load in the boat, I took out a bunch of tackle so I could get across the sandbar. Well, I took the biffle bugs out on Fort Gibson. So I'm freaking out, and I'm like, Josh, you
got
any?
The one place it works.
Yeah. He had one, so he tossed me one biffle bug in a biffle head. And I caught my whole limit on that one biffle bug. I was, like, cutting the head off, and I caught, like, a four-pounder on it.
He cashed a check on that one,
yeah,
one bait.
On one bait. Bait. Yeah, awesome. So he saved my tail on that one.
I was so preoccupied. I'm sure I had more. I left. I ended up leaving and didn't even leave him more biffle bugs. I should have. I feel so bad now.
I only needed the one. It's cool.
I'm glad it worked out.
Yeah, he's a one biffle bug kind of friend. You have your friends in life, maybe two, three. Mitch is a one.
That's right.
And that's if he plays his cards right.
Yeah, he's like, here you go, sport.
Mitch is a one. Nick, I don't know if you're getting a biffle bug.
Dude, I might get like the tail of the plastic that's been used.
That's funny. Those are some great trips, man. I remember the first tournament we fished in. I thought about this one. I don't know why it came to my head, but just to give Nick a little jab here.
What? not worth it.
You know, we're pre-fishing on Louisville, and this is our first tournament. We ended up, you know, by the end of the year, we're sharing a bunch of information. We're really close.
It
and
had
the
warmed
rest is
up,
history.
Right? Yeah.
But our first tournament we had ever stayed together, we're going to share some info, but, you know, you don't tell each other exactly like where you're fishing and stuff like that. And fishing is brutally, brutally tough. And I'm practicing with Nick. Mitch is practicing with Mark. And our buddy Tommy is practicing. Like, Nick and Mark were switching out and going with him a little bit too. But I finally find some fish on the dam. And I catch a couple big ones on an A-rig on the dam. And Mitch comes in. And Mitch caught a 5-pounder that day, practice or something like that.
Yeah.
And he shows us the picture of the fish, and you say he caught on an A-rig, and then Nick goes, did you catch it on the dam?
Hey, man, it's a big lake. There's a lot of different, you know, it's not a
like, there's like giant chunk rock, like a wall behind
a
me.
A truck driving across the access road. Is that the dam? Dude, that Louisville tournament, I freaking caught a diaper on a jerkbait. Do you remember that, Josh? So,
dude, it was he had not caught jack all practice, like a couple of drum, and he's finally all excited because he's got a fish.
Loaded up.
Dirty diaper.
Get the net for this one and some gloves.
Oh. Classic. Oh, right on. Okay, well, let's move a little bit off the college, and, you know, we were talking about, you know, how you were able to string boats together, string old trucks together to get from tournament to tournament, and, you know, both of you guys, Rob and Mitch, you've got older Triton boats that you've been able to keep running for a long time. And it's one thing if you're just a casual angler and you're fishing once a month at a local lake. Dude, you can keep a boat looking brand new with pretty minimal maintenance. You wipe it down every time you get off the water, do your service every year, and you could have a 25-year-old boat that still runs and fishes like new. But when you're guiding full-time like Rob does, when you're fishing tournaments around the country like Mitch does and has done for the past 12 years, you know, it's not easy to keep a boat in good shape because, like, when you're using it like that, all the weaknesses get exposed, right? So, like, what are some of the areas on the boats that you guys have to, like, look for and give a lot of attention to? Like, what's something that breaks that hasn't broken is gonna break if you're gonna use it hard.
I mean, I would say the trailer has probably been the biggest issue for me,
and it's totally underappreciated.
Yeah, exactly, right? Because you always worry about the boat, but not how do you get to the lake. And I've had so many blowouts, or hubs gone bad, or bearings blowing, or trailer lights out, and a lot of it was from necessity. When things would break, I would learn how to fix them. But that was the biggest key, is I would learn how to fix them instead of just taking it to a shop. Or when I would take it to a shop, I'd say, okay, I need this fixed, but I'd appreciate if you could show me maybe what you're doing here. Because a lot of that stuff happens when you least expect it, and you need to be able to fix it on your own.
Rural Oklahoma.
Exactly,
right?
Yeah. And so I think that's the biggest thing. And ever since I started paying more attention to the hubs and the bearings, I haven't had nearly as many problems.
Interesting. So you were the first guy I ever met that carries an entire extra pre-packed hub.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yep, the whole assembly.
Yep.
And I've started doing it since, because you saved my butt one time, dude. I blew a hub out. He's like, I got an extra one. He threw it on for me, and we were good to go. But, dude, brilliant idea. And they're not that expensive, right? Like $100 you can get a whole hub assembly.
Yeah, maybe $100 out for the whole thing with bearings and everything. And you can pre-pack it with grease, and you can do that whole stop and 15 minutes, whereas if you had to pack it and dig everything out, or if you don't have one,
yes,
that could be hours or a day.
Yeah, I've been fortunate with the hubs on my trailer, because I've got I think they're the oil bath hubs.
Yep.
But I just replaced my trailer. I actually took the hubs off my old trailer and put them on this. I bought a used trailer because my other trailer rotted out, literally just rusted away.
That's amazing.
But
in Arizona, too. That's
well,
the crazy thing.
The reason behind it is it's not the C channel, it's a tube trailer.
Okay.
And if
it's
I fished
water.
If I fished on the weekends, it wouldn't be a problem. But when you fish every single day and it doesn't dry out, it's just going to turns into a rust bucket. So I've switched the trailer out, and it's the trailer I have underneath it is okay. It's not great. I'm not going to drive across the country with it. But one thing about, Josh is saying having a boat and a motor, and the more you use a boat, the better for the motor and the batteries, in my opinion.
That's a good point right there, actually.
Obviously, you're going to have wear and tear, and you're going to have maintenance and stuff like that. But if you let them sit, I mean, that's the hardest thing on them, in
stuff
my opinion.
Stuff gums up.
It's just tough on them, you know, and your batteries go bad, and
And look at what the ethanol and the fuel does to everything nowadays.
Just anything
so
rubber.
Brutal, if that gas sits in your boat for 3 months, it's not good at all.
Yeah, but I mean, like Mitch, my trailer's probably been obviously my biggest issue. But the boat itself, I mean, I used to have boats back in the day that would just shatter, just cracks everywhere, right?
Oh, yeah.
I've got a 11-year-old boat, and there's not one crack in the fiberglass.
That's amazing, actually.
It is amazing.
Yeah.
But I don't run them like I used to either. I used to run boats super hard when I was younger, and, I'd have them for a year, and they weren't my problem after that. So
yeah,
it is what it is. But nowadays, I guess it's the gray hair, and I don't go as fast anymore, and that's probably part of my motor longevity, is the fact that I don't run it at max RPMs all the time.
4,200 RPMs, what's your sweet spot, 4,000?
Yeah, I'm running somewhere in that range. I run 35 to 45 miles an hour on my GPS, and I have clients with me all the time. I don't want to scare people. I've scared enough non-boaters in tournaments back in the day. Probably not a good thing to do.
You scared that one guy in the boat on the gypsy trip. Everyone heard that one on the
that, that was not.
What about?
Trying to suffocate that guy.
And that was the guy who stood up and said, slow this thing down, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was cold, and it was taking the wind out of it.
Sorry, dude.
Yeah, so. But that, I mean, I just putz around like a grandpa now, so it is what it is.
Obviously, that's good for your motor, though. So, it's something to take note of. I mean, how many hours do you have on that motor, man?
I don't even know.
Knock on wood.
It's only a three-digit meter.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a good point, though. Like, even when I'm pre-fishing or fun fishing, I'll only run 40, 45. And you see a lot of guys out there, and they're running
hauling ass.
Full out, on pre-fish days. And it's like, you don't have to be running 75. Like,
oh, yeah.
There's no reason to push it that hard if you don't have to. I mean, obviously, sometimes if you're running out of time to pre-fish,
if you ain't first, you're last. Practice or not,
dude. Here's the thing: if you got to get across the lake, it's one thing. If you're, if it's 1 o'clock on a practice day and you're like, dude, I'm done on this lake, light it up. But you can learn so much by just looking around, watching your GPS, looking at the bank, and thinking about things as you run when you're going 40. when you're going 70, you're just death grip on the wheel trying to not crash. Right, exactly. You know what I mean?
And I've got a funny story about that. Do you know the name Dave Glebe?
Oh, yeah.
So that dude's won like 50 or 60 bass boats, right?
Wow.
Not in the last... He hasn't done much in the last 10 or 15 years.
A Hall of Fame bass fisherman, Northern Californian.
For sure. Like one of the Western icons, for sure. Well, I drew him in a Bassmaster tournament at Lake Mead, and we couldn't decide whose boat we were going to take. It was the shared boat type deal, right? Mm-hmm. So neither one of us was given, and we ended up flipping a coin, and I won, right? So we run all the way up the lake. Guy's fished forever and won all these boats, right? He's in a blue jean jacket and blue jeans. And
were they hustlers?
He's like, I'm cold.
I'm like, really, dude? This is your first time out? They're definitely hustlers. For
gonna, that's going to be our first merchandise item for this podcast. Hustler jeans.
The hustler jean shorts will be coming out soon.
And then we'll get sued.
Sorry, Rob. Yeah. I want to hear where this is going because this guy clearly has fashion sense as well as fishing sense.
For sure. So anyhow... I had my half of the day, and then your partner gets their half of the day, right? And he told me, he says, I'll go with you. The only thing, I have to drive the boat when it's my turn. I'm like, what? So I'm like, whatever, no big deal. So he sits down behind the driver's seat, 10:30 in the morning, 11 o'clock in the morning, whatever it was. I said, where are we going? He goes, I don't know. Lights a cigarette. Puts a boat barely on plane.
Legendary.
And putts around, right? I had caught one fish up until this point. It was a really tough tournament.
You're freaking out.
Yeah. Because my bite was in the afternoon, and now he's pulling me off my fish. I'm like, whatever.
You needed one of those Winston Salems you was smoking.
Totally. But he puts it up on pad and literally is just putting around, had no idea where he's going, and just finds a spot, pulls down, comes off plane, walks up to the front of the boat, makes a cast with a jig, right? First cast, he catches a fish. I'm like,
holy Rain God. Man.
Right.
Dude, yeah. He's
Thank
like
goodness
meditating.
It was the only one he caught for the rest of the day. But I was like, holy cow, that's impressive.
Well, you got to feel
that,
it out.
That was just his feel. And Josh, valid point, man. If you're running full out from point to point or whatever, you're missing so much.
Yeah.
I see birds, dude. I mean, it could just be two herons on the bank that you – would not have seen because they blend in. And,
oh, yeah.
You know.
Or you see big boulders or trunk rock up on the bank. 100%. That usually carries into the lake down in a vein or something. So
totally.
Yeah,
totally.
But if you're going 70, you're not seeing that.
Yeah, Oh, yeah. Lot of reasons to go nice and easy. And, Mitch, I mean, dude, so you actually, you're on your second motor on your boat. You bought a new Pro XS a couple years ago. But how many motors did you get or hours did you get out of that first motor?
The other one had over 1,000 when I sold it. And it was.
And you still were able to sell it?
Yeah.
That wasn't like,
I sold it for like
scrap metal?
Almost 4,000 or 5,000.
No,
it was
kidding.
Still in good condition, still running good, yeah. And that's just routine maintenance, you know? Make sure you do the plugs, get everything greased up, change the impeller when you need to. But the hardest thing on a motor is either running full out or idling, right? Mm. But a lot of the times when you're pre-fishing, you have to do idling, so you can't really handle that. But
you can limit the all out side of it.
And then just when things break, don't let them just continue to break or drive around with it broken. Fix it when it breaks. Mm-hmm. I think that's the biggest
thing. Great advice there, man.
Because things just continue to snowball, and then all of a sudden everything on the boat is broken, and then you don't want to fix it, and then things just fall apart because you don't care anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So
you just kind of described my boat ownership experience. So that was very succinct. As I was listening to you lay that out, I was like, You know, I think one of the reasons why your boat ran so well is remember that one night tournament that we had together at Apache when I might have plugged something in and it shorted everything out. But luckily, I'm very mechanically inclined. I mean, pretty much everything I touch falls apart.
Yeah, I learned that real quick.
And this was still early on. This is like the honeymoon of our friendship. And we were... we maybe have talked about this, so forgive
me. I can't
remember, dude. So to the listeners, I apologize. But Josh had one of his buddies. You were with Dave Stokowski, right? And then Mitch and I were going to fish a night tournament at one of our lakes here at Apache Lake. And it's a canyon lake, right? So on a night with no moon, it's fairly hard to navigate if you don't have a functioning spotlight. And lo and behold, we got pretty far down away from the ramp when I... Dude, did I plug in like into one of the cigarette lighters and shorted something? I did something stupid.
Well, we figured out what happened. So you plugged in, you went to plug in like the black light at the time.
Uh-huh.
And that was one of the 12 volts that had the fuse in the plug itself. but it had started to come unscrewed. So the fuse had fallen
out.
Didn't make contact anymore.
So
when you plugged it in, it shorted it out.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't realize that till later, obviously.
So I proceeded. I mean, we like idled back. It took forever. But I proceeded to take Mitch's electrical system apart to the point where it was like.
And hey, this is the middle of the summer in Arizona. The next day, they're going to try to fish the tournament that night. So it's like 100 plus degrees and, you know.
Well, lovely conditions. I took that thing so far apart, and I was faking it till I made it. I figured I'd find a smoking gun. Things would be good. I just bolt it back and look like a stud. I didn't
know. That's brutal. They got it fixed, and they just didn't even fish it. They're like,
no, we were so tired at that point. Yeah,
yeah, that is
no,
a morale buster.
Drove home. Yeah.
You still talk to me, though.
Yeah.
And your boat still
works.
Well,
you redeemed yourself another time. We were at Roosevelt. It was actually the same time you guys talked about earlier when I might have hit you in the back of the head with a spinner bait.
The Ledge Buster story. Yep, yeah. That was like episode 7, I think.
Yeah. So later that day, we had an eventful trip. The motor wouldn't trim up. So we're fishing one of the rivers, and Nick is in the water, standing in the water, trying to get this thing fixed. And it was pretty cold, so I was like, oh, I'll figure it out. This is good. I appreciate the commitment.
Going
to
for
it. Yeah, getting in the water
trip.
For us.
And it ended up being one of the relays had gone out. And so we figured out that if you switch the relays, you could turn it up, or you could trim it up. You're just going to trim it down. So we ended up getting it up. But, yeah, Nick jumped in the water for it, a team player.
And I not very good at many things, but I can get it up with relays. Sorry, we've digressed. Rob shaking his head over there.
All episode long, he waits for something like that. Yeah, I love it.
You just drop a bomb.
Yeah.
Good job, man. All right. Well, those are good tips, man. That's really cool. Let's go into our technical fishing aspect of the show before we wrap this thing up. Right now, and it seems like every podcast, we live in Arizona, but every podcast, we're always like, oh, we had a weather system move in this week in Arizona, and we talk about it every time, but we did again. And tomorrow we're fishing post-frontal. I think Rob and I are going to try to get out to Roosevelt. You're invited. Probably not going to happen. Mitch, you're totally invited, dude. I don't know what you have going on. We'll talk about it later. But we're going to go post-frontal fishing, and let's talk about post-frontal fishing when it's cold. It happens, all year long, but it's especially a big deal when it's already cold because fish are looking for warmth. No matter what part of the country you're in, whether the water's in the 50s or even already the 40s, winter fishing on a warming trend is ideal. And, we're about to do the opposite. We've got this front rolling through right now, and you could probably go out right now in the rain and catch them doing almost whatever you want. But once that rain stops, the wind stops, you have a really cold, clear night and a cold, clear day. What's the first bait you guys are pulling out to try to catch them? We'll start with Nick.
Yeah, thanks. I usually use live water dogs. Totally kidding. No, I think of, and it's just like the cliche thing, right? But slow down.
Yep.
Right. And so, like a football jig, fishing real slow, deep. I don't know, man. Like that's.
Yeah, it's a great. I think that's a great.
That's yeah.
Approach.
That's immediately where my mind went to.
Yeah, football jig, or maybe deep. Or obviously we're the drop shot capital out here, but something a little bit slow. Maybe a little bit more finesse than a football jig.
Yeah, maybe a shaky head or something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go the complete opposite direction. I'm going to go with a crankbait, rattle trap, something moving fast, get a reaction bite out of them. We're going to Roosevelt tomorrow, and plenty of times on a cold, super cold morning, you can get that reaction bite going. So probably, hit the bank pretty hard with a crawdad type crankbait, medium diver.
That's perfect. Yeah. I mean, in both, I think both of those are like, I don't think there's
complete
a wrong
opposites,
answer there, but
right.
They both work. And I totally agree with you, Rob. Like, if there's one reaction bait that works really well after a front, it's a crankbait. They're not going to come up and hit a topwater. They'll hit a jerkbait. It's kind of in that right deal. But a crankbait is like, it's the deal. Tomorrow it'll be jigs and crankbaits on the deck. And
that's when it's critical to grind the bottom with it and, just make contact.
Entice
with
that,
just get that reaction.
That deflection, that reaction is a huge deal. And so like this time of year, a lot of times I'll go to like more silent crankbaits. You just talked about a lipless, and that's not silent. And it really works. But if you're talking about a diving crankbait, I really like a silent crankbait. Not just to plug Berkeley, but they've got a crankbait they released last year called a Fritzide. absolutely deadly post-frontal winter crankbait. It's silent. And I don't know how much like wooden flat, how many wooden flat side crankbaits you guys have fished, but you know, the real issue with like wooden flat side cranks is they're a pain to cast because they're so light. You almost have to throw them on a spinning rod, something like a shad wrap, or, you know, there's a bunch in the Southeast that guys throw. This thing is, it's plastic and it's weighted, but it fishes like balsa. So major plug there, but it's a cool crankbait. It's definitely, and they make a few different sizes. The five is my favorite. You don't have to, you know, when we're talking cranking, you don't have to have a crankbait that dives 25 feet deep either, do you, dude? I mean, you're talking.
No, I'm talking shallow.
Yeah.
For sure. And I mean, what colors are you going with? Like crawdad type colors?
Totally. Or, reds, yeah. Greens, stuff like that. You know, so a lot of times, like after a front two, you're going to maybe have a little bit more stained water depending where you're going to fish. So my favorite wintertime cranking color is red. You guys fish a lot of red this time of year?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And it's weird how these are our lakes in central Arizona set up. I mean, you could go to Canyon or Saguaro and crank for days and never run into a fish, right? And
totally.
And then you go to Roosevelt and Bartlett and those type of lakes, and I, you know.
So you think that's just like habit or like structure related, or what do you?
I think it's just forage related. Mm. I think there's more crawdads up shallow in those lakes. I really do. A bass, I mean, they're gonna live where the food is, and no matter, I mean, we think it's cold. That, you know, as long as they're eating, they're fine. You know.
100%. Yeah. I mean, those fish that, if you're on a lake and you're catching fish in 40, 50 feet, they're probably eating shad, to be honest. Right. I mean, those fish, the shad will go that deep. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're on a lake that's warm enough for the crawfish to still be somewhat active this time of year, you definitely don't have to go super deep. Now, you definitely can. You're talking about deep football jig fishing. Mm-hmm. You can catch a fish in 40 foot on a football jig. We've all done it a billion times. But I think it's definitely the deeper you go, it's definitely more shad oriented. One other thing too is like, I really find that the time of day is like super critical this time of year. When you're fishing post frontal, because the feeding windows are so short that, and even taking the moon out of this, I think you're going to get a feeding window early on and then late. And then that window, that time period between 8 a.m. and like noon or 1 p.m. is going to be really tough. Do you guys see the same thing?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, and that's when you're going to probably get out deep and try to get those negative type fish to entice them to bite.
You've kind of missed that reaction window, and then it's time to slow down. That's interesting. So when you say a silent crankbait, do you think that's just because you could overdo the stimulation from like the rattle knocking on top of, you know, everything else?
I think so.
Yeah, just like that happy medium of there still is a reaction bite to be triggered, but don't overdo it type of thing.
I think that's a pretty good way to put it. What do you guys think on that?
Yeah, I agree, but I'm still down with the rattle trap for some reason.
Yeah, you know? It's funny. It just works.
That's such a weird bait. That's a true reaction.
And I haven't thrown that a bunch. So is that like what's the deepest you would throw that, Rob?
I'm just going to cast it to the bank and wind it in.
And bring it back towards the top of the water column,
I mean, just, you know, you're going to slow down a little bit with it, but you're not slow rolling, bouncing off the bottom. Yeah. You're just winding it. So that's the weird one. I mean,
that's probably more lake specific. That.
Mm-hmm. And it's huge back east. You know, out west, we're fishing it in kind of an open water situation, maybe taking a treetop or something like that. But if you go back east, Mitch, have you ever fished any of the grass lakes back east where you're literally, I mean, you're just fishing it on grass. It's a total grass deal.
Oh, yeah. I mean, back east or even here, I mean, even at Saguaro. Some of the best fishing I've ever had is ripping a crankbait out of the grass at night. And I can't tell you how many times Sean and I have had mega bags at Saguaro just fishing crankbaits through the grass. And it's finding the right depth of crankbait, whether it's a rattle trap or a 6XD or 10XD, whatever it might be, depending on how tall that grass is growing at the time. But it'll be year-round as long as that grass is there, which is cool. You just might have to change the depth of it or the color of it.
That's where the bait becomes a tool. You're just using the right tool for the job, right? Yeah. To get to that depth. Mm-hmm. So
you can, and you can, if you've got the right crankbait and you're getting a little bit into it a little bit too much, you can go to maybe a little bit heavier line, go to a little bit heavier rod so it can come free. But it's a sneaky little way to catch them in the grass. And if you go to the lakes southeast, like Gunnersville and a lot of the Tennessee River lakes, Chickamauga, Kentucky Lake, and just feathering that thing through the grass is a huge deal.
So the trebles don't ball up, they don't load up with grass,
and you need the right type of grass too, right? So the more lively the grass, the much more likely you'll be able to get your crankbait through it. If you've got dying grass, your crankbait touches it and it's collapses on it, and
that's the thing, you come off. You know, when you're fishing grass, you see guys rip it. Essentially they're balled up in the gas and they're ripping it through the grass, and that triggers bites a lot of times.
That's where you get the bite.
And then having the right depth crankbait is key, because if you're trying to throw a deep diver
and you're dredging
and the grass
is
at the top of 8 feet, I mean, you're going to be dredging straight into it. But yeah, like Josh was saying, when it's good, healthy, like hydrilla, it almost feels like you're fishing a crankbait over a rock.
It's amazing the way it feels. Yeah.
And it's funny, because when you're fishing it, and you feel it bouncing across those, you're like waiting for it. You're like, it's going to hit one more stock, and then it's game on.
Isn't that like the best feeling in fishing? Whenever you're like technique specific, and you can feel like you've dialed it in, like you said, you're ticking rock or something like that, yeah, your confidence goes through the roof.
Yeah. You get the angle, I just came over the tree. These are the rocks, okay.
But as a beginner, it seems like a daunting task to figure that out and get in that right situation. They don't realize, I mean, even guys that are experienced, it doesn't happen all the time. You can't, I mean, that's a perfect scenario, right? When you're hitting the grass at the right depth.
And that's kind of why I asked that question about loading the trebles up, right? So there's some trial and error, right? Tons, like you got to figure out the depth that the crankbait's running. You had mentioned maybe upsizing line or upsizing rod.
But as fishermen, we only talk about those little moments that we're
right.
The
right
0.01%.
Totally.
Yeah. Well, which is fine.
That, I was going to say, can be even like rod angle. Because if the grass is never going to grow at the same depth, right? It could be 5 feet, 7 feet, or 10 to 12. But as you're reeling it through there, you start to get a feel for how deep that crankbait's running. So if you start to feel it snagging a little bit more, you can start lifting your rod tip up a little bit so it starts ticking again. And then if you start feeling it too free, you can bring it back down. So you kind of adjust with it on the cast. I wish it was just as easy as casting out and reeling it in, right? But
No, that's the skill of it too, though, right? Like you get 100%. A feel for it, you get a touch, and then you know, you take it from there. Yeah, I don't know. A crankbait is just a super versatile bait, and intuitively throwing it to grass seems like not the right thing. But now having talked through it with you guys, totally makes sense.
Oh, yeah. One last thing you can do in addition to this stuff is go to braid. I don't really suggest it on any lipped crankbaits. David Fritz, the master of deep cranking, cranks on braid, dude. All his cranks. But I've tried
it.
Does
he have the softest rod ever to behind
it? Same rods we use, man. He loves the depth. He loves the feel. But it's everyone's different, and I don't really know too many other people that do that, or really anyone else that does that. But on a lipless bait, braid's still really popular. It really is. And lipless baits are a little bit different because excuse me, I'm just battling off a cold right
winter
now.
Winter time, love it.
Yeah, exactly. But on lipless baits, one of the biggest fears with throwing braid and treble hooks is the fish throwing the bait, right? Like there's no stretch in the line, so you don't want to pull the
one jump is gonna
hooks out of the fish. Yeah, exactly. But with lipless baits, they're a little bit more compact, and you can get away with a little bit bigger hooks. And when a fish eats a lipless, a lot of times they're really getting it good. And if you upsize the hooks and go with extra wide gap hooks, EWGs, that fish is swallowing that bait, and you can get away with braid, and you can get away with fighting that fish a little harder than you normally would. Like, you're not going to hook a fish on a deep crankbait and then reel it to the boat as fast as you can. I mean, you're going to lose more than you catch. But with a lipless, they're getting that entire bait in their mouth. You've got those upsized hooks. Now you got braid. So
you got a lot of leverage.
You can get them in the boat, man. Have you guys ever tried that?
Yeah, well, I was just going to say, I'm curious, what are your thoughts on like EWG versus round bend? Like, I know in my case, I like to throw EWGs almost all the time on like deep diving crankbaits.
Same
but
here.
I've always kind of wondered, is there a time when you should be throwing a round bend? Is that something that you've ever come across?
For sure. And it's one of those things that, again, it's kind of all opinion. And, you know, I'll go a couple years really feeling that I'm doing it the right way and then change, you know. But I totally keep a stock of both, man. And like on a smaller bait that a fish is going to be able to inhale, I almost always suggest using EWGs. If it's a bigger bait that they're just slapping at, I like round bends. And I mean, that makes sense. That's pretty common across the board. I've noticed a lot of people will do one and one, and on diving crankbaits especially, and most guys use the EWG in the front and then the round bend in the back, which kind of makes sense because, you know, if they just slap at it, they get the back one. I tried a few years ago, I tried the opposite. I tried the round bend in the front and an EWG in the back. And dude, I had such good luck. This was with a big topwater bait. I had such good luck getting the fish that just had the back hook into the boat. You know, when you have one just hooked on the back hook, you are literally praying don't come off. And they come off half the time. And that one tournament in particular, you were there, Mitch. It was at Table Rock. I was catching my topwater. And, I caught, like, several fish just on the back hook on that EWG. So, since then, even on crankbaits, I like that EWG in the back. And I'm the minority on that one. But, I don't know. It works for me right now.
It's interesting.
Yeah. But...
trial and error, man. That's what it boils down to, right?
Exactly. Yeah, and everyone reels fish in differently. Everyone uses different rods, you know, so exactly.
Kind of finding your sweet spot. And
just because Mitch says it or I say it or Rob or Nick says it or anyone says it doesn't mean it's the right thing for you. It's just, you know, just playing with it.
If I said it, though,
just forget it.
Don't take it. Right, if there's anything you took from this.
I'm so old, I still use mono, so it is what it is.
It's hilarious. Are you using Aberdeen or bronze-colored hooks,
bronze
Rob?
Hooks.
Eagle claw.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Lead weights.
I mean, that's a good point, though, and Josh said it's whatever you're comfortable with, right?
It's a confidence thing.
When Sean and I were out there, we'd always have the debate, right? He'd be throwing, like, 12-pound mono on these crankbaits.
Interesting.
And I was throwing 10-pound fluorocarbon, and we're catching 20, 25 pounds at night, like over the rocks and grass and stuff. And I'm like, dude, you're going to break off. You don't have enough. And he's like, you're throwing 10-pound fluorocarbon. What are you talking about? You're going to break off. But it worked for both of us, and they were completely different. He had a ton of stretch in it, and we threw different treble hooks on it, but we both caught fish, and it worked for both of us how it should. So
that's cool. We're going to get Sean on the show. Is he not an old school fisherman or what for his age, dude? He fishes
is.
Old school.
Oh, yeah.
I love it. He's really good.
Bait, spinner bait, yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, he's solid. He's just a natural.
He is. That's exactly what he is. Spends a ton of time on the water, and we want to talk to him, too.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm sure he'll get into it with Sean when he's on the show, but he didn't have graphs on his boat for the longest period of time. Like
he must have been trained by that dude Rob was talking about where he just smoke a cigarette slowly.
Glebe. Oh, yeah. He's Glebe's apprentice.
Yeah, it was unreal. He'd come fish the ASU stuff with us, and he was in high school, and he'd come out and fish with us just for fun, and he'd be running around out there in his skeeter with no graphs on his boat, and he would whoop us.
Ray Charles, baby. He just feel it.
We're like, who's this high school kid coming out here with no graphs?
Sean's like the first guy I call when I haven't been on the water for a while.
Oh,
just,
yeah.
Just to get me dialed in.
Oh, yeah.
He's phenomenal fisher.
A little fishy, huh?
Very fishy.
He was trained originally, dude. Do you remember Butch Hopkins?
I do. Yep. Yeah. I can't forget him. Dude. Man. That guy's a stud.
He was. But, yeah, he taught Sean a lot in the beginning.
Yeah.
Right on. Well, dude, this was awesome. Man, hopefully we can get on the water with you soon, Mitch. And, dude, great to see you. Anything else you guys have for him?
It's just good to see you, man. Thanks for my birthday present, by the way, showing up here and hanging out with me.
Yeah, no problem. It's been a pleasure being here and talking to you guys and throwing some old stories around.
Yeah. Heck yeah. Anything else you got have to add, Mitch, or any sponsors you want to thank or anything, dude?
No, I don't think so. Just appreciate you inviting me to be on here.
Awesome. Cool. All right, guys. We'll do it again soon. Thanks for listening, guys. We appreciate you all subscribing, sharing, and reviewing the podcast. Don't forget to hit up the guys at SmartLink Alarm to enter the drawing for the free guide trip. Go catch some fish this week, and we'll talk to you next week.